sorry, you're a bit of a lost cause. So, and that, I mean, that plays out in my story over and over and over, is admissions and then kind of like, we don't really know what else to do with you. I was told I was chronic. I was told to learn to manage my symptoms because I'd never live any other way by all these experts.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castanini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to today's show. I'm really excited to bring on our guest today. She's here with her heartfelt story of her journey with her eating disorder, and I'm always especially honored and privileged when people come on and share their stories, because I think there's a particular kind of heartbreak that comes with an eating disorder for the person living it and for the people who love them and feel helpless watching it take up more and more space. And one of the coolest parts is how easy it is to lose hope, especially when recovery feels messy, non-linear, or like it's working for everyone but you. And in this episode, Heidi McLaughlin shares her story with so much honesty and courage, from the early pull of anorexia to years of treatment that left her feeling misunderstood, to the moments that finally helped her believe healing was still possible. We're going to talk about fear, identity, control, motherhood, nervous system regulation, and the kind of recovery that doesn't just look good on paper, but actually feels sustainable in real life. I think this conversation is really going to help a lot of people out there feel less alone. So I'm going to go grab Heidi and get this conversation started. All right. Well, Heidi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm really happy you're here too. And I really appreciate anybody who's willing to come on and, you know, share their story, because I think that's, you know, it's really hard to do. And I know for a lot of people, there's a lot of vulnerability that comes with opening up about their experience. And so I just want to leave it to you to where to start in terms of like, where do you want to start with sharing, you know, your story with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I'm kind of an open book. I spent a lot of years with this as my identity and told my story, you know, every time I'd be in a treatment center or something like that. So I got real tired of telling my story. Mm-hmm. And now I've kind of circled back to a place where it feels really good. It feels empowering. And, you know, I think for me, this has become so much of my like life purpose that it's fun to share that there is another side. So yeah, I first started struggling with an eating disorder when I was like 13. Didn't really amount to much until I was closer to 15. And for me, it really started, like, I specifically remember thinking, I think I'll just start biking a little bit more and lose some weight. And for me, there was a lot of, I wouldn't necessarily say that I was bullied in school, but I definitely felt different. I grew up in a home that didn't have a TV, and all the girls would play Sailor Moon on the playground, and I didn't know what they were doing. And, you know, getting into high school, there was a lot of like partying and things I wasn't allowed to do, and always just felt different, right? And that paired with being an awkward, you know, kind of preteen, teen, felt really like I didn't have much of an identity. And that goes all the way back. So when I first started kind of losing a little bit of weight And I can specifically remember sitting there and somebody said to me, "What have you done different? And what have you been doing?" And I remember thinking like, whoa, somebody noticed me. Somebody noticed me for something that they thought was a good thing. Right? It was almost kind of like they were coming to me for advice, something, I did something well. And I felt for, you know, a little girl who felt like she never really did anything well, it was, I remember specifically in that moment being like, whoa, could this be my thing? Could this be like what makes me different or special or fit in or any of the things? And I feel like it was like right in those moments that it kind of sealed my identity right there. And I used it for years and years and years. That was kind of my story. Of course, you know, there was this perfect storm, right? So making that choice in those moments didn't cause an eating disorder for me, right? That's not how it works. There's a biological piece. There was, you know, the environment, the whole thing came together to kind of create this perfect storm that left me struggling pretty deeply with anorexia. I did a lot of the work from home. I have amazing parents who supported and wanted to help me in any way they could. The first time I saw a doctor, he just said, "Go home and eat cake." Oh. That wasn't that helpful.
I was not. But I'm curious though, like, how did you get to that point where you went to the doctor for help? Like, how did you even, how did you tell your parents, or did they notice? Like, how did that even like come about? Because I think that's one of the hardest parts, is identifying something is going on and then seeking help.
Yeah. So to the best of my memory, to be honest, it's all a bit of a blur for me. I think I was pretty undernourished, which didn't help my brain. And so I don't have real great specific memories, but I remember my mom getting more and more concerned. So I think it started with just with like eating less and exercising more and then being more afraid. I remember going to the beach. We would go with friends and ride in their boat and, you know, refusing to eat the pizza, and my mom being trying to coax me and wearing a sweater on the boat because I was so cold, and, you know, all the kind of typical things that happen, right? And I think my mom just got concerned enough that was like, "We need to take you to the doctor." That felt like, you know, the only thing that she knew to do. So I don't think I really admitted it at that point or wanted to. I still felt pretty tied to it. Felt like a safety net, like a bit of a life raft at that stage. But my parents definitely noticed and got worried. So that's where it started. And they kind of gave me an ultimatum, like, if you don't gain X amount, then we're hospitalizing you. And so at that point, that was enough, put enough fear in me that I kind of let my mom run the show a little bit. And they kept me on a pretty close, like, watched me pretty close, were pretty, you know, on top of things. I remember being in high school thinking, "I can't wait to move away from home so I can quit eating." Like, I very much was like doing it just to kind of keep them happy, right? And I did some, I'm in Canada, so treatment looks a little bit different up here. Did some outpatient stuff. I don't feel like anything really shifted much for me until later on. So yeah, the first time I would say I really kind of went into treatment with specifically what felt like my choice a little bit more was more when I was 19 and away from home and ill and all of that. So yeah. Yeah. So that kind of started the whole cycle for me of, I moved away when I was just barely 17. I graduated when I was 17, moved like hours and hours away, lived with my sister, went to university or college and kind of quit eating and just progressively got more and more ill until called my mom one day, said, "Things are pretty bad." She came, and then I was, admitted to the hospital. Then, and that kind of became a pattern of being either admitted or having to move back home in my life, of every couple of years, either admitted into a treatment center or hospital, or moving back home, kind of, and then trying again, and then, you know, the back and forth. So I won't get into all of those details because we could be here all day. There was a lot of admissions and a lot of different treatment centers and a lot of things like that.
You know, but I'm curious for you, like, even before you went off to university, you said you were just kind of waiting to leave so you could just reengage in all your behaviors. And I think that's a lot of people's, you know, desires even or fears of like eating. And, you know, that's the underlying thing is like, they just want to really engage in the eating disorder behaviors. And I'm wondering for you what that was like to have your parents take the reins on the one hand, but also at the same time, really just like waiting it out until you could leave. Like, do you remember that fear of like gaining weight or like doing what they were saying to avoid the hospital? And because I think that's the biggest struggle a lot of people have with the eating disorder is like what body changes are going to happen. And if they don't engage in the eating disorder behaviors.
There was that, there was definitely that fear. I would say I'm maybe a little bit different in the way that the disorder played out. A big part, and of course, this is like retrospectively, right? At the time, I had no idea this was the thing, but a big part of it was I felt no safety in my body, kind of going back to some things that happened in childhood. And that lack of safety, like the eating disorder was a safety piece for me, almost more than even the weight control. It really felt like it was my safety net. It really, I don't know if you've ever heard of the log story by, I think it's Anita Wolf, but yeah, she talks about, and that is just like 100% the way that the disorder played out for me. It was like, it was my life raft. And so everybody could kind of, you know, take control and do the things. But to me, it still felt like the safety net that I needed. So yes, there was huge fears around weight gain and also just these huge fears around letting go of this thing that felt like my thing. So, yeah.
Well, also too, you know, you discuss something that I hear so often, which is kind of that big hit of dopamine, like that pleasure when you get noticed for something and oh wait, I matter. I'm doing something right. Like people are giving me positive feedback. Like this feels good. Why would I want to stop this? Right. It's almost like this great positive reinforcement. It's like, that's very motivating. And that's like very almost, I want more of that. This feels really good. And so I hear that moment a lot for people. It's like that did something to me.
Yeah. And I think you kind of build your identity on that, right? It became like this thing that was so close to who I felt like I was, right? I was this person who had willpower. I was this person who, you know, and was that intrinsically who I was? Yeah, there's pieces of my personality that align with that. And then also, I think I kind of programmed myself to be that way, right? Because this is who I decided I was. This was the story I created for myself, and I lived that out, right?
So you go off to university, and it's interesting. You said your sister was there. Did she notice anything and alert your parents, or was this all like you eventually calling your mom saying, hey, something's not right, I need help?
Yeah, I feel like that answer would be yes, but also, man, it feels like the disorder was so much just a part of who I was by that point and a lot of points in my life that everybody just kind of like, here we are again. This is just what is, right? But I think I did get to the point where, yeah, it would definitely raise some red flags. I'm not sure, you know, exactly how that went, but I do remember me specifically calling my mom and her riding a bus for hours and hours and hours and coming to help me and get me admitted and all of that. So I'm sure it was both, but I definitely remember feeling something that made me make that call and kind of admit defeat almost.
Yeah. It's interesting you use that word defeat. I'm wondering if there was this healthy part of you inside that was like, I need to stop this. I need to get help.
Yeah. I never denied it. Maybe as a teen, I denied it. But by that point, it was like, I knew this wasn't synonymous with who I wanted to become, right? I knew something had to change. I just had so much fear with the letting go of what felt safe. So mm-hmm. yeah, it was a bit of like admitting that I didn't have this under control. I think that was the defeat of like admitting that I was losing the battle, right? Because it was easy. I mean, this had become so much a part of my story that my mom would check in on me, right? How is your eating? How is? And I, oh, it's great. It's wonderful. So kind of the admitting defeat of like, it's not great. It's not going well.
You know, and even that word control, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm imagining like most people when they're in the throes of the eating disorder, you feel so in control. Like I'm controlling yeah. everything. This helps me feel grounded. And then to the ironic part is like, you're so out of control. You have yeah. no control over anything. And just that realization, it's so hard to get to of like, wait, mm-hmm. wait, I'm actually not in control of anything. And to get to that yeah. for yourself is such a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all an illusion, right? That feels very in control. And in reality, when you know, take a step back and get an actual look at it, there is no control. It's just this illusion of feeling in the moment in control.
And maybe people listening might be confused with what we're talking about, but mm-hmm. it's almost like if in those moments, like when you go back to, you know, your days in university, someone would have said, hey, can you, you know, eat a cookie? Here's one. Mm-hmm. Or can you not work out, you know, today? Like, mm-hmm. what would you have said or what would have happened?
I would have lied. a lot of manipulation. I've already eaten. Sure, I'll take it for later. Oh, I've got to go do this. I'll take it with me. As far as working out, I mean, I would have found any way just to manipulate my way out of it. 100%. Anything. It felt like you were asking me to sit with venomous snakes. Like it really was that, you know, and I know some people hate the dramatics of, you know, statements like that. But for me, and honestly, for a lot of the clients I work with, it does feel that dramatic. It really did feel that much of a danger kind of to my primal brain. So I would have done anything to get out of it.
Was there ever any part where you were confused a little bit too? Like it felt like, oh, I'm doing all these things that are quote unquote healthy or are good for me, or mm-hmm. like, no, this can't possibly be anything like that's going to harm me because these are all behaviors that are in society deemed as like mm-hmm. healthy and good instead of yeah. like, they can't possibly hurt me. I don't know if you were at that point where it was very confusing at any time or.
Mm-hmm. You know what, initially, like as a kid, I have memories of that, of thinking like, oh, well, pizza isn't healthy. This isn't healthy. But to be honest, the way the eating disorder played out for me, it was always pretty apparent it wasn't about health. Mm-hmm. It was very, you know, it was me harming my body. I was pretty open. I was pretty clear, I would say, I would scream health from the rooftops. I'm doing this to be healthy. But as far as my inner knowledge, I knew. I really always knew that, you know, harming myself at the gym or refusing to eat the thing, I knew that wasn't true health. I was always pretty conscious of that fact, but I would tell you it was healthy to kind of keep it alive.
Sure.
Yeah.
Was there relief when your mom drove or came all those hours to mm-hmm. come get you and brought you in for help, or like for treatment? Was there any party that was like, okay, yes. I'm going to get help. This is mm-hmm. going to be finally the time where this all stops and ends.
1,000%.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1,000%. That was exactly it. I can remember that first meeting when I was getting admitted and me kind of sharing, you know, the stomach problems and the this and the that, and him saying, that's an undernourished brain. That's an undernourished body. That's, and just feeling like, oh my God, this could change. Very much a huge, huge sense of relief for me.
Yeah. And I know, you know, maybe you don't want to get into details or the nuances of it all, but mm-hmm. Did you actually feel like when you were in the treatment, the intense treatment, that like once you were discharged, like, okay, now it's a whole new phase. Like, this is behind me.
No, I got kicked out.
Oh, you got kicked out? Oh.
Yeah. I got, maybe we should say I got asked to leave.
Okay.
So yeah. You had to gain X amount of pounds per week. And you had to really show up. Well, number one, as somebody who was exercising heavily and severely undernourished, it historically, every single admission that I've ever been in takes me a lot of nutrients to gain weight. That's just how my body reacts. And now I can look back and be like, that's just what my body does. But at that time, I didn't have that knowledge and neither did they. And so they kind of chalked it up to me not trying hard enough or using behaviors, which I wasn't. So I wasn't meeting the weight goals. And then also I got told that I needed to leave because I wasn't crying. So something the eating disorder does really well for me or has done is completely numb. When I'm undernourished, I kind of feel nothing. Completely numb. Don't feel happy. Also don't feel sad. Crying, I couldn't remember the last time I cried. And so in therapy sessions that they would have, I wasn't crying because I was so numb. I had nothing. And that was seen as like I wasn't doing the work. So those were the two reasons I was given and kind of just like, we don't think this is working. It's time to go try something else. Which was pretty scary, especially for my parents, because I was really undernourished and had really nowhere else to go. So then I did move home because I wasn't well enough to stay there. And yeah, very interesting the way that some of those treatments work. I'm sure I'm not alone in this, but look back and wish it was different, but it is kind of just part of my journey.
What do you, I mean, if you could go back and have it be different, you say that you wish, like what would your wish be? How would you have? Yeah, if you could have a time machine, your wish, what would it be?
Yeah. Oh, man. I wish that, like, this Heidi could go back and just sit down and be like, let me tell you about an undernourished body and an undernourished brain. Let me tell you, which is kind of silly. That feels like they should know that. But maybe I'm different in the way it plays out for me. And I've also had lots of experience and done lots of research around this stuff now. But I feel like it would be very easy for me to say, these are the things that are happening. This is what's going on. There's no deceit. There's not hiding. You know, I was just kind of seen as somebody who was treatment resistant. And I really wasn't. I was terrified. I was numb and frozen. So I wasn't resistant. I was just really, really scared, you know? So I just wish that I could go in and explain and also just like help that version of me see that I wasn't a broken, useless, hopeless person. Yeah. I just didn't understand me and neither did they. Yeah.
So, you know, that's really interesting, right? Because you're in a place where you're getting specialized treatments, right? Mm-hmm. And so did you feel like, you know, you're being punished for like being asked to leave?
Yeah, kind of more, less punished and more just like, you aren't, I don't know how to say it, more of like, you aren't, we don't think there's any hope for you. Ugh. Right? So less punished and more just like, sorry, you're a bit of a lost cause. So, and that, I mean, that plays out in my story over and over and over is admissions and then kind of like, we don't really know what else to do with you. I was told I was chronic. I was told to learn to manage my symptoms because I'd never live any other way by all these experts that are supposed to understand. So that kind of played out for me over and over and over of just like figure out how to manage it because nobody really believed there was anything to hope for me.
So, I mean, if we could get only if you're comfortable, but just a kind of time frame wise in terms of like when this was in terms of treatment, because I know things have significantly changed over time, right? In terms of knowledge and awareness and treatment and things.
Yeah. Yeah, so that would have been like 2003, four, kind of. I was 19, I'm 41 now, so do the math. Kind of around in that area, yeah. And
Do
that, again, progressively, like until, 10 years ago was really my story. So I wouldn't say it was only then, it was kind of that was the, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm a bit older than you, but also, having gone through my own experience, I would say like the predominant, I guess myth I call it now is like, oh, you're always gonna have to live with this, right? Recovery, full recovery was not really like talked about or encouraged, or I don't know, it just wasn't discussed. And I think treatment has definitely changed a lot, thank goodness, since then. But it kind of pains me to hear you say like this was your experience.
And it became my story too, right? When you go somewhere vulnerably for help, right? I remember several admissions fast forward and remember going in, so desperate, right? Just like somebody say you have some sort of a solution. Like I wasn't under any pretense that this was a good thing in my life anymore. I was like so desperate. Just please tell me you have an answer. And to sit in that chair, looking at that person with like, and kind of it was in my calendar of like, maybe this time somebody will say something different. And to have that like eating disorder expert look at me and be like, I'm sorry, you're chronic. This is just life. So let's figure out how to manage this, and you're going to live like this, so you can expect. I remember them telling me if we can get it so that we only have to admit you to hospital like every 1 or 2 years, that's the goal. Like we're just going to try and like make it so that you're not here every 6 months, and it's just like, oh, that was kind of the goal, is just keep you a little longer in between. So
What did that feel like? I'm just curious to hear that.
yeah, I mean, hopeless, right? What's the point? I think those are the points when, I could really understand why people would give up on life altogether. Why? I mean, what's the point? Right?
I mean, did you in the time that you were in treatment, I'm assuming you also talked to other people that were in treatment with you, did you see anybody who had a different idea about what their outcomes would be, or had more hope, or I'm just curious.
Not until I moved away. So this is after I was married. I moved away and went into a treatment center that was several hours from where I lived. And that was the first time that I ever remember like being with other girls that were like, we are not, this is not our story. And it was the most refreshing, coolest. I feel like that was a turning point. Because before then, so in Canada, in where I was, it was specifically in Saskatchewan, we don't have eating disorder treatment. So what typically happens is you're just admitted into hospital to kind of like get, things under control, and then the psych unit. So there's like a couple spots in the psych unit for eating disorders, but it's a psych unit. It's a scary place to be. Was there a few times, not fun, not cool, but also, I mean, I would go in and be relieved because it still felt better than the torture of the disorder fairly often for me. So that wasn't, you're with maybe one other person struggling with an eating disorder who's also in a psych unit, pretty hopeless. So I never really saw other people that were like, let's do this, until I went to this treatment center away from home that was also in a hospital, but a specific eating disorder treatment. And so I made some friends there, and that was kind of a big turning point for me because I felt like other people who had had these, disorders for a long time still had hope and maybe I could breathe through them and still have hope. And yeah, things definitely, that was probably my best treatment story, if you will, like the feeling most hopeful, both in it and coming out of it.
So, I mean, it sounds like this was this very like long journey for you from like when you said 13 to all of this. And was there a point where you can say that was when things started to really change for me and go like, or trajectory to like more hopeful and what was that?
Yeah, definitely a couple. That admission that I'm talking about, that was a big shift for me. But then also, so I was married and had my first baby in 2015. So kind of got pregnant, wasn't real healthy, but did my best, had that beautiful, amazing baby in 2015, and then went downhill real fast after I had her. And I actually ended up being admitted into hospital when she was 3 months old. And that, I mean, it still makes me like cry to talk about. That was kind of the hardest, probably the hardest moment of my whole life. This, my first baby, this brand new, she was, you know, perfect little angel. She was 3 months old. And I just really felt like I'd failed at life and failed her, failed my husband, you know. So my, yeah, so to, and had to be away from her, right? I was breastfeeding her. And so then it was just a whole like, really, really big heartbreak. And so that was the moment where I was like, I remember them telling me, this was in hospital, you have two choices. You can either spend your time here drowning in guilt and shame, because that's what I was doing, or you can figure out how we turn this around so that you don't spend your whole, her whole life in this same scenario. So that was kind of my first moment of like, you know, I have to, something has to change. I can't do this, right? But by then, things were pretty ingrained for me, my identity. I mean, this was so much of my life and story and history. And so, yeah, I spent 3 months in hospital, got out when she was 6 months old. And that was just amazing to go back to her and to be on a different path, and did really well. For a long time. And then the next kind of shifting point, if we want like the true, like I am done point, I got pregnant with my second baby in 2019 and had her in 2020 and felt some of those same things coming back up of like, you know, postpartum is a lot and exhausting, and it's a very easy place for the eating disorder to just take over. And I was like, I am not doing this. I refuse. I cannot go in hospital with another amazing little baby. And this baby in a lot of ways healed my heart, because I had had, you know, torn away from my other baby. And so just, I was just like, I want this experience to be what I missed with my first baby. And that's when I actually started coaching. And that was the first time when somebody said to me that this isn't a like, Heidi's broken, you have this big bad eating disorder that runs your life and we just need to manage it, and you like stay quiet and small and we'll, you know, keep this big bad thing at bay, right? It was this viewpoint of like, actually, you hold the power in your life. You just can't quite see that yet, because you've created such a big story around this and your whole life has kind of revolved around it. Mm-hmm. And your authentic recovery doesn't have to be, you know, the textbook, do this, do this, do this. That's clearly not working. So how can we spin this on its head and figure out what's one step forward for you? And so just that sense of like empowerment and somebody, you know, who didn't know my whole story and weren't looking at a chart saying like, well, that's been an awful long time, good luck, honey. You know, it was somebody with fresh eyes to just be like, actually, I think you could do this. And that was such a turning point for me. It was like, taking my, like, as, you know, as lame as it sounds, it was taking my power back, saying, like, I'm not just a victim to the eating disorder for the rest of my life. I actually could have a voice. And yeah, from there, that's kind of the turning point of my recovery. I worked really hard. I did also a lot of somatic work, a lot of energetic, a lot of trauma healing. I did Reiki. I did, you know, all the energy work, all of that to really clear out, find safety in my body, build back a sense of identity that wasn't just, you know, this person with the eating disorder that I had created for so long. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that leads me into deciding I wanted to be a coach and kind of living that out now in my best life because it means everything to me to be able to do what I needed.
That's amazing. And I mean, I could just, as you're talking, and maybe people aren't able to see if you're not watching this, but you just started to glow and like smile as you're talking about that time of your life and all the changes you made. And it is empowering when you have somebody give you a different message and instill some hope, right? And your energy shifts and changes and you realize eating disorder is not part of your identity.
Yeah. It's not part of your identity and that you have a choice. Like I felt for so long like I didn't have a choice. The eating disorder was what happened to me and in me, and I was just a victim to that. And so to have this, like, you have a choice to manage your mind, right? You have a choice in what thoughts you let take over or push away. You have a choice, you know, energetically in some of that to just like change your energy, to do the somatic work, you know, all these little like nervous system regulation tools that I do all the time now to help myself feel safe in my body, help myself, you know, manage anxiety or any of these things that come up and are part of who I am. I have all the tools that I was never taught. So it's put it all together, you know, and I don't want it to sound like, oh, I just magically found recovery. Like I created what was authentic to me and helped me heal, right? So that looked very different from what it does for my clients or, you know, you or anybody else, because it was my recovery. And that's what I really hold so close now with what I do is like, I'm not here to tell you what your recovery needs to be. I'm here to help you like discover all the missing pieces so that you have a sustainable recovery that feels amazing, right? And it's just so fun and so incredible to feel like you can help people put the pieces together. You know, it's everything.
Yeah. And to your point, that's why I love having people on here because it's not one path and one treatment and one way for everybody. It's messy. It's not linear. Yes. It's like all over the map. And I think there's power in that for people to listen to everybody's different stories. But yet what's so interesting to me is regardless of all the different stories, when you really hear them, it's that hope, the hope that makes all the difference. And that there's this moment of like, wait, I can overcome this. I can recover. Mm-hmm. And getting to that point where you hear people saying like, wait, I did recover. My life is so different. It's the absence of the eating disorder. You can get there. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part that like reminding yourself over and over again, like you can live without your eating disorder. It doesn't have to be your identity. It doesn't have to be all consuming. And so I appreciate you sharing that because for so long, it sounds like you weren't given that message or you didn't believe that that could even be true.
No. And it's hard to believe in something you have no evidence of, right? If, you know, I always tell this people when they're like, well, how can I find hope? It's like, how do you believe, you know, for me, how could I believe in recovery or freedom when I had 20 years of evidence that it didn't work for me? I had plenty of evidence. Like I could see like, oh, I read a book that it worked for other people. Cool. But I had zero evidence it worked for me. So it felt like everybody was saying like that wall's pink and I could only see blue. It's not pink. I can only see blue. You might see pink, right? So it really is like part of, you know, I think the way that we actually create recovery is to take it really small, start really small, and start to rebuild your ability to see that there is hope, right? Giving somebody hope is one thing, but helping show them there's hope for them in these tiny little steps and wins and, you know, reframes and all of that is a whole different ballgame.
Oh, totally. And acknowledging there's fear in moving toward that, because to your point, the eating disorder for so long served a purpose and it was functional, and there's fear in like, what happens if I don't do this, or if this is my identity, or, you know, there's so all much. Sorts of things that happen along the path, and it's not just, oh, I don't want to do this anymore, or life's going to be so much better without it. It's, there's pitfalls and hurdles, and
it's messy. It is messy.
It is messy. And so I'm glad, you know, you're coaching people through this too, because I don't know how people could do it all by themselves. I don't know your thoughts on that. But.
Yeah. I think, you know, I would never want to limit anybody to say like, you can't do it by yourself, you need a coach, right? I think anybody can do anything they decide. I think it's really helpful to have somebody outside of your brain. Because when you're really in it, especially in an undernourished brain, it's really hard to see, you know, the walls blue, right? So I think it's really helpful, and it's such an amazing tool for people to be able to see something different. And then there's, you know, it's amazing. There's podcasts like yours and other resources out there that can help people. I think you could, I want to say anybody could piece together a recovery, no matter your resources or what you have access to. I think coaching is an amazing asset to be able to kind of help you move forward and really create your specific recovery.
So that being said, how can people get in touch with you or find you on social media if they want more information or to touch base with you?
Amazing. Yeah. So I'm pretty active on Instagram. And I'm sure you'll leave that in the show notes, but it's ed.recovery.coach. And you can DM me, reach out, no sales pitch, no pressure, no nothing. I really love to connect. I feel like every time I connect with somebody, it's like heals a little part of me too, who, you know, didn't believe anything. And I coach a lot of teens and work with a lot of parents as well. And then a lot of adults who've kind of lost hope. So you can reach out to me anytime, whether that's, you know, an interest in coaching or just want to learn more, or you have any questions about me, my story, always 100% an open book. I can give you my email address as well. Love to touch base with anybody.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing. And again, congratulations on, you know, all the work that you've done to get here, and on your kids and everything.
Yes.
So thank you again. Any last final words before we end?
I think that's pretty much everything. If you remember nothing else, just please know there's always hope. It's never too late. You're never too old. You're never too broken. Nothing. There is always a way. We just haven't found it for you yet.
Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.